Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 15th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Holy Ground That Spouts Fire, The Cascade Volcanoes, presented by Rick Dunning. This number, DUW2005-09.
And you can tell where the name Image Link is derived. It's a wonderful spot to see. And of course, we know from Mount St. Helens that things are still happening in these Cascade volcanoes. We've had some activity, little bits of steam and ash coming out over about the last year and a half from Mount St. Helens. It's been a little hard to tell if that's a forerunner of bigger things to come or if it's just letting off some pressure. But we know that. These volcanoes are all considered active volcanoes, and potentially any of the Cascade volcanoes could erupt again. All of them have shown some kind of eruptive activity in the last 200 years, mostly a little bit of steam or ash now and then. Even Glacier Peak has hot springs along the flanks of it. So we would have to class them all as active volcanoes. Clearly, St. Helens is the one that's been most active recently, but certainly not alone that way.
Could you excuse me, but sure. For those of us that I'm familiar with, I come from the prairie. Just exactly where are the Cascades? Just
yep.
Give me a...
I'll flash some maps at you so you're okay. Sure what we're seeing. Yep, absolutely. So this is sort of our popular image of how a volcano behaves, spouting lava and cinders and things like this. This is an eruption in Hawaii. And so we need to think about what a volcano is and how it works a little bit. And to think about volcanoes, we've got to think about the Earth in a little bit bigger picture first. Because we have to understand what's fueling this volcanic activity. And in geology, the most important theory in geology is called the theory of plate tectonics. So you might know it by its older name, continental drift. The idea that the Earth's crust in the outer shell of the Earth is relatively thin and rigid, sitting on a deformable interior. You could sort of think about the Earth a little bit like a soft-boiled egg. The very center has some liquid molten rock, and around that the rock is solid but deformable, like the egg white of a soft-boiled egg once it's been cooked. And then the crust of the Earth would be like the eggshell around that. So the relatively speaking, the shell of an egg is much thicker than the crust of the Earth. If we could shrink it down to the same size, the crust would be a very thin shell around a squishy interior, a deformable interior. Or if we were even being more specific, the Earth's crust is a thin shell around a hot, squishy interior because there is heat inside the Earth, some of it left from when the Earth formed and some of it still generated by radioactive decay in the center. It's almost like the Earth has a giant nuclear reactor inside that's still producing heat. So the center of the Earth is almost as hot as the surface of the sun, almost the same temperature. And so this heat from the interior of the Earth is escaping outward toward the surface through that squishy interior. And the rigid shell of the crust on the outside is not a single solid shell, but it's broken into pieces. And the pieces of this outer shell of crust shift around, pushed around from below by the heat that's rising from inside the Earth. And this is a map of the pieces of crust, as best we can tell. So we live here on what's called the North American plate, the North American piece of crust. That includes North America, of course. But it also includes a bit of the Atlantic Ocean floor and Greenland. That's one big piece of crust. The Pacific Ocean floor is a big piece of crust. We've got the South American plate, the African plate, the Eurasian plate, the Indo-Australian plate. Of course, that was famous this last December because a little shift along here produced that big tsunami in the Indian Ocean. There are seven or so very large plates and a bunch of little plates, little pieces of crust tucked in between. So we've got the Caribbean plate and the Cocos plate and the Nazca plate, Philippines plate. So the whole outer surface of the Earth is broken into pieces that shift around. And that's, of course, a mind-boggling thing to try and imagine. It's one of the great wonders of geology to have articulated this theory and then documented it. We now have the technology using satellites and radar technology. We can measure how much North America moves every year. We can measure the shifting of every plate every year.
Yeah, now, where the Juan de Fuca plate is indicated, does it overlap with the North American plate about where Washington?
Well, we're going to have to talk about that one. That one matters right there. You're exactly right. So we're going to have to talk about that one a little bit. Just remember where that's at.
Yeah, okay.
And if these pieces of crust are shifting around, then the really interesting stuff geologically happens on the edges of the plates, where they interact with each other. Those are the areas of the Earth that are most dynamic. And essentially, there are three kinds of plate boundaries. You could have places where pieces of crust are spreading away from each other, pushed up and apart by heat rising from below. There are places where pieces of crust are colliding together. And when that happens, then one piece of crust is pushed downward under the other, eventually just gets reincorporated into that squishy interior that we talked about. And there are places where the pieces of crust rub against each other sideways. So they can diverge apart, they can converge together, or they can move laterally, sideways against each other. And we've got examples of those all around the Earth in various places. And we don't get to talk about all those examples today, but we want to think about them a little bit. And the one that we're going to pay the most attention to is this one, where two pieces of crust collide together. Now, this is the Atlantic Ocean floor. If you could take all the water out of the ocean, you'd find right down the middle of the Atlantic Ocean is a big mountain range. This is one of those places where two plates are pulling apart from each other. And I'm just going to draw some arrows on here for a second. Excuse me. Let's see if I can do this. So down the center of the ridge here, North America has been moving this way, away from that center point. South America is moving this way. Africa has been going off this direction. Europe's going off this way. So this is England up here, Spain, so that's Europe. This is the bulge of Northwest Africa, South America, North America. And so all these pieces of crust have been spreading apart from the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. It's one of those places where they diverge. In other words, as North America is moving this way, the whole plate is getting bigger. There's crust being added onto the backside of the plate. As the plate split apart in the center of this diverging boundary, new rock rises up and solidifies to form new crust and new plate material. And then that splits apart, and then more rock rises up and replaces it. So we've got the very youngest rock on the ocean floor right in the center of the ridge.
And is that Iceland at the northern edge?
And this is Iceland up here, sitting right on top of that diverging boundary. And in fact, there's a crack that runs right through the island where it splits apart. And there are active volcanoes there as a result of that, and hot springs and things like that. So they live right on top of that boundary where it splits.
range growing in height, or is it about the same size?
It stays about the same size. The reason there are mountains in that area is that from underneath, the crust is being pushed up and then pushed apart. So the motion would be from below like this. As a hot rock rises from the Earth's interior, and so one plate is diverging this way, and one plate is diverging off this way, pushed apart by that rising rock. And then this is the gap that then hot rock rises up and fills in the middle of that gap, and then that splits apart and spreads. So it's being pushed up from underneath, and it's being pushed apart from underneath. And that's what makes the pieces of crust spread in some of those areas.
And it looks very granular. You can see there's kind of a grain.
Right, it's broken up into little segments. Uh-huh. It's not one continuous ridge, but the whole ridge is broken up into little segments, mainly because of the curvature of the Earth's surface. You can't have one single straight line because the Earth's surface is curving.
And what is that fault called? What is that?
Well, this whole ridge is the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, and the center split is the rift, the Mid-Atlantic Rift in the center of the ridge.
Is that higher in the middle there, or
yes.
Is it lower?
It's higher in the middle. Well, that dark area right in the center is a little valley like this. So at the top of the ridge, there's a crack, and that's what's showing up in this diagram.
So it's deeper where it's dark.
Right, a little deeper right in the crest of the ridge.
Not closer to the shoreline.
Oh, over here it's deeper, yes.
It's deeper there.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Where is Iceland?
Right up here at the upper right-hand corner.
And that's got to be generating heat.
Yeah.
So does that affect the Gulf Stream or the...
Not so much. It doesn't change the water temperature too much. See, as this rock rises up and solidifies, you've essentially got continuous low-grade volcanism happening here. Hot rock is rising and cooling. So there is some heat flow, and there are some very odd life forms that live in this area on the ocean floor and live off that heat. Just very unusual, odd ecosystems that are totally developed away from sunlight down on the deep ocean floor, and they live off the heat as their energy source rather than sunlight as their energy source.
What is the depth?
Well, the deep part of the ocean floor typically is in the range of 18,000 feet deep. And so the ridge would be probably at least, the top of the ridge would be at least 5,000 feet below the surface.
So that's quite
a range. It's a big mountain range. Now, if we could see that, we would be very impressed with how big that mountain range is. And of course, nobody knew about this thing underwater until after World War II, when sonar technology allowed us to map the ocean floors. That was part of the big impetus for developing this theory of moving crust, was once people saw what the ocean floor was like and some of the unusual features there, that helped to tie together some of the early hypotheses about the continents moving around. So it's pretty cool stuff. The plates move about as fast as your fingernails grow.
Oh, that takes a lot of flipping.
So
submarines have to be aware of it.
Yeah, they've got to know where that ridge is, absolutely.
Is that
Greenland?
This is Greenland up here, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Let me go back to my other pointer here. Now, here's, as I say, the one we've got to pay more attention to. This is what happens when two pieces of crust collide together, especially if there's a continent involved in the collision. One piece of crust is pushed downward, as we talked about, and it begins to melt because of heat and pressure and friction. So if you start taking part of the ocean floor and melting it, that makes lava. And then the lava rises up toward the surface, and it can erupt to form volcanoes. And so that's where we find many of the world's volcanoes, is in places where pieces of crust are colliding. And it's the collision that produces the lava that makes the volcanoes. The lava isn't coming up from the center of the Earth all the way to the surface. The heat is coming up from the center of the Earth, but not the lava, even if there is molten rock there. The lava is all being generated here in the crust where the crust is colliding together.
Is always the plate that has the ground on top of it the one that is the superior one, and the one that has the water is the inferior?
Well,
down, or is that?
Let me add a few details. That's a good question. The rock that oceans are, or continents are made of is different than the rock that the ocean floor is made of. Ocean crust is rock that's heavier and more dense. It's got heavy minerals in it. And continental crust is relatively light, low-density rock. So when the two meet, it's always the ocean crust that goes down because the continental crust is so light compared to it. Now, you can have places where two pieces of ocean crust meet, and the same thing happens. One goes down, and there's melting and volcanism there. In that case, it's generally the older crust that sinks because in being older, it's colder, and being colder, it's heavier. And again, the heavier stuff sinks more readily than the lighter stuff. Fortunately, that rule doesn't apply to people. Older doesn't mean colder.
Not necessarily.
Nah, not at all.
But it's just weird to think all that can happen under the water. You'd think that the water would put all the hot lava out.
The other thing, of course, that's happening here, and we want to pay attention to, is that rock on the edge of the continent is getting crumpled up, getting deformed. And when two pieces of crust are colliding, it's a slow collision, but it's a continuous collision. And the rock eventually deforms because of the pressure of that collision. Just as if you backed your car into a wall, it's going to crumple up the back end of the car. Well, here the edge of the continent is getting crumpled up. So there's volcanism going on, but there's other kinds of uplift and deformation and mountain building also taking place wherever two pieces of crust collide. And so when we look at where there are mountains in the world, and mountains aren't everywhere, but when we see mountains, we find them in the western U.S., and western South America, and all around the Pacific Ocean, really. We also find them across southern Europe, the Alps, and southern Asia, the Himalayas. Those are the places in the world of active uplift and deformation, around the Pacific Ocean, across southern Europe and southern Asia. Those are where young, high, active mountain belts are. Now, there are older mountains, like the Appalachians in eastern North America, or the mountains in Scandinavia and the British Isles, or the Ural Mountains in Russia. Those are mountains formed by older collisions. They're no longer active. They're no longer being deformed. They're old mountains kind of being eroded away now. But they are sites of former collisions. Everywhere we see mountains on continents, you could think, oh, there must have been plates colliding there at one time. Either there are now or there was sometime in the past. But the active mountain belts includes most of Western North America. Again, because North America has been moving westward, colliding with the crust under the Pacific Ocean, and that collision has produced the mountains in the western part of the continent. Same thing in South America. It's moving westward, and so you get mountains on the west edge of the continent.
Could you just say what a continental shield is?
In each continent, there is a core of older rock, sort of the original core of the continent. And there are places where that sticks out at the surface. And so here in the center of North America is the older rock, the old stable rock of the continent. The very oldest rock of the continent. And most of the continents have some sort of central core of older rock. Now, one piece of evidence of this active mountain building would be earthquakes. And this is a map of earthquakes, earthquake epicenters. Where the crust moves, that's where earthquakes happen, because that's the cause of the earthquake, is the shifting of the crust and the sudden release of pressure. And this map of earthquakes is almost a perfect map of the plate boundaries. We've got the Mid-Atlantic Ridge producing some earthquakes. But notice around the Pacific Ocean, we've got lots and lots of earthquakes there. And here, where we saw that December tsunami earthquake, right in this area, southern Europe, those are all active collision zones and sources of active earthquakes. Most of our volcanoes occur along those plate boundaries as well, especially on the plate boundaries where things collide together, like all around the Pacific Ocean, the Pacific Ring of Fire. The whole Pacific Ocean is surrounded by volcanoes because the whole Pacific Ocean is surrounded by points of collision between two pieces of crust. Remember, we said the Atlantic Ocean is getting bigger because these plates are spreading apart. If the Atlantic Ocean is getting bigger, that means the Pacific Ocean is getting smaller. So it is surrounded by collisions, and wherever you've got crust colliding together, you've got volcanoes forming. And if you think about the last decade or so where we've had reports of volcanic eruptions, they've been in the Philippines, they've been in Japan, they've been in the Aleutian Islands, in Alaska, Mount St. Helens, in Central America, in South America, in the South Pacific. Active volcanoes all around the ocean because there are active collision zones all around the ocean.
So if the Atlantic Ridge is widening,
yes,
is there actually more pressure in the Atlantic Ridge, looking at it from a very meta standpoint, as opposed to the Pacific?
Right now, the rate of spread is such that what's happening in the Atlantic Ocean is forcing the continents together in the on the Pacific side, yeah.
And it's interesting how many fewer volcanoes there are in the Atlantic Ridge.
Right. Like I say, it's mostly low-grade volcanism, just lava oozing out in the center of that ridge.
Okay.
There is active volcanism in Iceland, because that's where the ridge is sticking up, so you can see them happening. But mostly it's just little eruptions underwater.
Okay, right. And which isn't looked at this
way. Right.
This is only...
These are identified volcanoes.
You know. Okay. Right.
And of course, across southern Europe, we've got things like Mount Vesuvius and Mount Etna, which has been active within the last decade, and other volcanism along southern Europe as well, another convergent boundary. Now, the one thing that's a little odd that's worth talking about is Hawaii. Because Hawaii's not on the edge, it's in the middle of that Pacific plate, the Pacific crust. Right in here, we've got an unusual hot spot under the crust. And the Pacific crust is rising over the top of the hot spot. And as it does, volcanoes pop up on the surface of the crust and eventually stick up out of the water. And so the active volcanism is on the Big Island of Hawaii at the bottom end of the chain, and the active volcanoes are on the southern end of the Big Island. And if you go further north, each island gets older and older because it's moved farther and farther from the hotspot as the Pacific plate keeps shifting. And there's a whole chain of underwater seamounts that represent old volcanoes that formed over that hotspot. So the hotspot's been there pushing up volcanoes as long as the Pacific plate's been moving.
Wow. And this recent steam vents off of Japan is some...
Well, that's more related to where the plates are colliding.
Okay.
That's a more typical converging sort of situation.
So is Hawaii kind of a pinch point for the entire plate?
No, it just is the whole plate's moving across that hot spot and So they say volcanoes just pop up above the hot spot and then the plate moves and a new volcano pops up. There is a new volcano underwater south of the Big Island that is forming. And eventually we'd expect a new Hawaiian island to poke up out of the water as that volcano gets bigger.
But not in a lifetime. What's the time frame for that?
Probably not in our lifetime.
But I heard that it's pretty big.
Yeah.
I mean,
I heard the ep is pretty big.
So the top of the volcano is getting up there pretty close.
Yeah. Really.
Okay, so again, this is North America, just a little bit of a close-up, and this is the area we want to kind of look at, because we're concerned about these mountains here. And remember, we had that little bitty piece of crust here, that Juan de Fuca plate, so we want to keep that in mind. But before we get to talking about the Cascade volcanoes, I want to talk about different kinds of volcanoes, because not every volcano works the same way. The kind of volcano you get, and in fact the kind of eruption you get, excuse me, depends on what kind of lava is being erupted. And I'm going to keep it pretty simple and just talk about two basic kinds. Fluid lava and viscous lava. Fluid meaning it flows easily like water. In fact, hot moving lava like this is literally flowing as fast as a river. So it's fluid flowing like water. And the viscous stuff is gooey and sticky and thick and slow moving. Now, that depends in part on its temperature, because hotter will be more fluid and cooler will be more sticky. But it also depends mostly on the silica content of the lava. And that, of course, depends on what kind of rock is melting originally. If rock without much silica in it melts, you get a low silica lava. If rock that does have a lot of silica in it melts, then you get a high silica lava. Well, the low silica lavas are the fluid ones. And the high silica lavas are the gooey, sticky ones. Now, this is on Hawaii. And those Hawaiian volcanoes are famous for these fluid lava eruptions. The lava bubbles up to the top of the vent and flows out across the landscape in rivers like this. Notice it's crusting over pretty fast because it cools. And as it cools, the lava solidifies. But under that crust, hot molten lava is still flowing. And here you see the same sort of thing happening. So it's crusting over, but it's also still moving, so that sort of plasticky crust is bunching up into this ropey, drapey texture. So these are Hawaiian volcanoes, and there are other places around the world that have these sorts of volcanic eruptions. Again, bubbling up out of a vent and then just pouring away, flowing away from that vent. Typical of low silica lavas. So that's brand new rock, just seconds old.
Yeah.
And often it's got lots of holes in the surface because there were gas bubbles that were trying to escape once the lava got to the surface. This is some of that ropey texture of what the lava looks like after it cools. So same sort of thing. It's fabulous to watch.
Waterfall.
It is just
exquisite.
Yeah.
How long does it take to harden into rock?
Once it crusts over, the crust acts like a kind of an insulation, so the lava under the crust can keep flowing sometimes for days and for many, many miles away. In fact, you get lava tubes that form once the surface of the lava has crusted over. Now, in general, these fluid lavas, when they erupt, don't erupt with much explosive violence. They may spray a little bit like this. If there's gas trapped in the lava, they may fountain a little bit. But in general, they're not dangerous eruptions. When volcanoes erupt in Hawaii, people don't run away, they go up to watch. You know, the eruption is a tourist attraction. So it's a gentle bubbling up of the lava and flowing away. Now the kind of volcano you get with a fluid lava looks like this. It's called a shield volcano because it's a little bit like a warrior shield lying on it with its kind of face up. It's a rounded, gently sloping shape. Because again, those fluid lavas spread out a long way from the vent. It doesn't really look like our typical volcano. It's not a cone-shaped mountain, gently sloping. This is Mauna Loa, one of the big shield volcanoes on the Big Island of Hawaii. That's the shape of a shield volcano, gently sloping, rounded in shape. Now, it doesn't mean it's not a big mountain. The top of Mauna Loa is over 14,000 feet. You do get snow up there. I've been up there and seen evidence of glaciers up on these big volcanoes. Yeah. So during the Ice Age, there were glaciers in Hawaii, in the highest parts of the mountains. But remember, these volcanoes originate off the ocean floor, 18,000 feet below the surface. So you put 18,000 feet underwater and 14,000 feet above water, this volcano is higher than Mount Everest. This is a very big mountain.
And stuff
coming all the way up.
Just the force of the heat?
Yep. It's amazing to think about. So these are huge mountains, and one shield volcano could cover as much as 100 square miles with that lava spreading out. This is the surface crater. So again, up on top, it looks almost flat. It's so gently sloping. This is Mauna Loa seen from Mauna Kea, the other big shield volcano on the Big Island. And you can see the lava flows that have come down off the surface, the recent lava flows off the top of Mauna Loa. And this is just a different view. So here's Mauna Loa in the background, Mauna Kea, both of them over 14,000 feet. Mauna Kea is the one where all the big astronomical observatories are, up on the top of that one. Up high in that thin atmosphere, not much pollution interference. Now, there's a smaller kind of volcano called a cinder cone. And it's what it sounds like. It's a cone-shaped pile of cinders. They tend to form when these fluid lavas start to cool off. Late in the eruption of a lava flow, the lava is getting cooler and cooler. As it gets cooler, it becomes stickier and more viscous, and it tends to explode a little bit more. And so that's when you get cinder cones forming, often on the top of lava flows. In fact, this shot is on top of Mauna Kea, so it's on top of the big shield volcano. But this is a cluster of little cinder cones on top of the shield volcano. So these are small cones of cinders. This is one in northern Arizona. You can get a sense of scale from this road, perhaps. Now, just a small mound of cinders around the vent, kind of a spouting, fountaining process. These are in northern New Mexico. Little steep-sided cones. This is in Craters of the Moon National Monument in southern Idaho. Some little cinder cones there. It's surrounded by lava flows, black lava that was fluid lava, low silica. That's why it's such a black color. Low in silica, so dark colored. But just at the end of these lava flows, then the cinder cones formed on top. This again is in Craters of the Moon in southern Idaho. And again, some cinder cones off in the distance. Sometimes you get these smaller cones called splatter cones that literally are from splattering lava fountaining out of a vent and just building up like that. So you get some odd little shapes like this. Now, let's switch gears and talk about a totally different kind of volcano. When you have a volcano in which the lava has a higher silica content, then you tend to get a more explosive eruption because the higher silica lava is thicker and gooier and more viscous. It doesn't flow as easily, so it tends to plug up the vent of the volcano. And if it does that, sometimes it can plug it up so badly that pressure builds and builds and builds, and then it comes exploding out. This kind of volcano is called a stratovolcano. And as you see, it looks more like what we think a volcano should look like. This is from Alaska. They've got a number of these stratovolcanoes there. On the inside, it's built up of layers of lava and ash. So sometimes you get a little lava oozing out of the top and it comes down the side a little ways, but it doesn't flow very far because it's sticky and gooey. And sometimes you get explosive eruptions and all you get coming out of the top would be ash. So the layer, the alternating layers of lava and ash build this cone-shaped mountain that we call a stratovolcano. This is Mount Shasta in Northern California. It's an example of a stratovolcano. And just to give you a comparison, Mount Rainier is a famous Cascade volcano, gives you the size and shape there, versus that Mauna Loa volcano in Hawaii that we just talked about. So you can see, even though Mount Rainier, from our perspective, is a big mountain, 14,000 feet high, big, impressive mountain, it is nothing compared to that big shield volcano in Hawaii. And then, of course, a little cinder cone would just be about the tip of the arrow there, sticking up on top. So, that's what the Cascade volcanoes are these stratovolcanoes. They erupt not the Hawaiian-style fluid lavas, but the stickier, gooier, high silica lavas. And so we've got a chain of these stratovolcanoes going from Northern California through Oregon and Washington on up into British Columbia. And so at the southern end, we've got Mount Lassen and Mount Shasta. At the northern end, Mount Baker, and of course, Glacier Peak. So Holden is sitting right about the L of Glacier Peak here. That's where we are. And Glacier Peak is straight to the west of us.
Then the Olympic Mountains are not a part of...
The Olympic Mountains are not the same kind of mountains. Nope, they've been pushed up, deformed. There's some of that crust that's been deformed and pushed upward, but they're not volcanic in nature.
Okay.
So those are the mountains we want to talk about. And since I've spent some summers out this way, I've had a chance to see a lot of the Cascade volcanoes, so we'll just kind of do a quick tour of them. Now remember, this is that little piece of crust we talked about, the Juan de Fuca plate. That little tiny bit of crust that's still being pushed under North America. And as that crust goes under North America, it melts and the lava rises upward, and that's what makes the Cascade volcanoes. That's the collision process that's producing these volcanoes in this part of our coastline. So again, here's the melting of the crust, and then we just get a whole chain of volcanoes right along that boundary between the two pieces of crust. As long as this collision keeps happening, these volcanoes are going to keep erupting. So, at the southern end is Mount Lassen. Mount Lassen was the last volcano to erupt before St. Helens, and it erupted in the 1940s. So that hasn't been that long ago. And it let loose a scorching cloud of hot ash and dust and just scorched everything down the mountainside. And so it looks pretty barren compared to most of the others we'll see. But that's the southern end of the Cascade Range. And then again, Mount Shasta. It's a pretty one, and again, we see the classic cone-shaped mountain. That's what we expect volcanoes to look like. That's what we grew up thinking they look like. Now, Shasta has a little parasitic cone coming off the side, so that at some point, the main vent of the volcano plugged up, and it started erupting off the flank of the volcano and started building a new cone over here. And that's kind of what happened in this case. Another view of Shasta, and again, that parasitic cone on the side of it.
Do you know when it last erupted?
Off the top of my head, I don't. I'm sorry. I'd have to look that one up. This is Crater Lake in Oregon. That doesn't look like a volcano, but it is. You have to imagine here a mountain in that place. So on this site, there was a big volcano sitting here. And the volcano erupted about 7,000 years ago. And it erupted with such violence that it destroyed the mountain. And what we're left with is, instead of a mountain there, we're left with a hole in the ground. So Crater Lake is one of the Cascade volcanoes. Essentially, it blew its guts out. And the whole mountain collapsed inward to form this big hole in the ground that eventually filled with snow melt and ice melt and rainwater to form Crater Lake. Now, there have been younger eruptions taking place in the bottom of the lake. And there are some young cones, and one of the younger volcanoes sticks up out of the water to form Wizard Island. So after this big eruption 7,000 years ago, it's still been active.
And how many times around the world did that ash cloud go?
That probably made it pretty well. That was a significant, compared to this eruption, Mount St. Helens was just a little burp. This was one of the biggies. The geologists refer to that original volcano as Mount Mazama. And Mount Mazama erupted. And there would have been probably early Native Americans living in the area. So there would have been at least eyewitnesses to the effects of that. And of course, if you remember from the boat ride up, Crater Lake is the deepest lake in North America. Which is another bit of a surprise. Remember, it's Crater Lake, then Lake Tahoe, and then Lake Chelan, the deepest lakes. So here's Wizard Island.
What's the definition of an active volcano?
Essentially some eruptive activity in historical time, in recorded human history. But it's a fuzzy boundary. You know, what's active, what's dormant, what's extinct.
But didn't they used to think that Mount St. Helens was dormant?
Some people probably described it that way, but a geologist wouldn't have.
What's the elevation of the lake?
That's a good question, and I'm afraid I don't know off the top of my head. I need to have my facts down a little better, clearly. From Crater Lake northward into Oregon, there are a bunch of little volcanic cones through the center of the state. We won't talk about all of them. This is one more look at Crater Lake. It's a spectacular feature. In the center of Oregon, as I say, a cluster of little cones. This is Newberry, a little farther north, and this is one of several called the Three Sisters, kind of to the east of Eugene. Another of the sisters here. A little farther north in Oregon is Mount Jefferson. And still farther... this is still Jefferson. No, this is Hood. Farther north is Hood, and it's Hood that you see from Portland. This is kind of a fuzzy photo. So Mount Hood is the one that, on a clear day, you can get a good look at from many places around the Portland area. This is up on the side of Mount Hood. All these Cascade volcanoes stick up in the air pretty far, and so they catch a lot of moisture coming off the Pacific Ocean. A lot of that moisture falls in the form of snow, so these are all mountains that have heavy, heavy snowfall, and that snow packs into ice to form glaciers, so they've all been heavily eroded by glacial action. That's kind of why it's all uneven along here. So they're being eroded almost as fast as they form. So flying out of Portland, this is one more look at Mount Hood, very pretty mountain. And as you fly out of Portland, if you look to the south, you can see Mount Jefferson, you can see the Three Sisters. So the volcanoes are close enough together, spaced out along this range, that you can, from one, you can see several others. So we've gotten as far as, we've gone from Three Sisters to Mount Jefferson to Mount Hood here. So when we cross the border, when we cross the Columbia River from Oregon into Washington, then we get Mount Adams, the first one we hit in southern Washington. Then we shift a little bit farther west and north, and we get to Mount St. Helens. Now you've got to imagine another 1,000 feet on top of here. Because in 1980, when Mount St. Helens erupted, it lost the top half of the mountain. And that's the thing about these stratovolcanoes. When they erupt in a violent phase, they can destroy themselves or partly destroy themselves. So they go through this history of building up and then blasting part of the cone away, or all of it away in the case of Mount Pazama. And then they build themselves up again, and then another violent eruption blasts them away. And it just happens repeatedly. So this is a shot of that eruption of Mount St. Helens in 1980. And in these violent phases, when the volcano erupts, there's no lava coming out of this volcano. No lava flows coming down the side. The eruption is so violently explosive that all the lava is pulverized into ash. So you get ash coming out of it, not lava flows. And of course, it's this kind of volcano that's the dangerous kind. They're capable of violently dangerous eruptions. So they moved people away from Mount St. Helens. At least they tried to when it erupted. Now, the initial blast of Mount St. Helens was sideways. That was kind of unusual. At first, blasted sideways to the north with a hot, scorching cloud of gas, superheated gas and ash, and that just blasted across the landscape. Essentially, and this is what the ash was like. It's fine powder, but if you look at it under a microscope, it's really tiny, tiny shards of glass. It's volcanic glass blasted into little pieces. Yeah.
What is the stone or gemstone helenite made of then?
The ash can't, if the ash falls and it's still hot, it can fuse back together to make you get a rock made of ash.
I see.
So if it's falling on the ground and still very hot, it can turn back into solid rock. So it's just very, very, as I say, very fine shards of glass. You can imagine what that does to car engines and windshields and your lungs if you breathe it in, or your eyes if you get it in your eyes. Imagine little shards of glass in your eyes. There have been instances of jet airliners flying through clouds of volcanic ash and losing their engines. And losing altitude rapidly as a result. Fortunately, none of them have crashed. They've been able to restart their engines, but you get that glass in an engine like that, it can cause some real problems. So this is the crater from the north shortly after the eruption. So as I say, it blasted sideways first, and then it blasted upward. What really happened is that as the lava rose upward, it pushed out the north side of the mountain. And a visible bulge started to develop on the north side of the mountain. So this eruption didn't happen without warning. The first indication of a volcano erupting is that you start to get earthquakes down here as the lava is pushing upward. So it gives you signals, and then they start to see bulges out the north side. And essentially what happened is that with one large earthquake, the whole north side of the mountain collapsed in a giant landslide. And then the initial blast went sideways across the landscape before the rest of it then went upward. And that was the surprise of the eruption. Not that it erupted, but that the initial blast went so far to the north. So it was this sideways blast first and then the upward eruption.
Rick, was that because the side was weaker than the other side?
Right, yeah. It was a little bit weaker the way it was bulging out, and that gave it a direction to head initially.
But
And then the wind was kind of blowing to the east.
Right.
Northeast, yeah. So
this is a photo from a weather satellite 700 miles above the Earth. And this is the cloud of ash coming out of Mount St. Helens. So the volcano's down here, and you can see that cloud going eastward across Washington into Idaho. Back in Minnesota, what we got were some nice sunsets with all that ash in the sky, but we really didn't see any of the ash falling on us.
Is that coastline on the left there?
Yeah, this is sort of the coastline right through here.
Wow, so give us an idea of some idea of scale on this.
Well, by the time it gets to about here, it's at the Washington-Idaho border, I suppose.
And where is Holden?
That is huge.
Holden would be kind of on the upper edge of that cloud, right about there.
Oh, right there.
Yeah.
And certainly there was ash deposited here on some days when the wind was blowing a little bit more northward. I can remember we collected some of that ash and used it for pottery glaze.
Oh.
We get some pots that were covered with this stuff. So this is kind of what it looked like, sort of a moonscape afterwards. Ash and debris all around the volcano just devastated the landscape. And one of the amazing things was that sideways blast just scorched all the foliage off the trees and knocked those big Douglas fir over like they were matchsticks. Just combed them over sideways.
Did it start a fire then?
No, they didn't burn. I think the force of the blast sort of kept it from, it sort of blew out the fire almost. So you could trace the movement of the air currents through the landscape by the direction that the trees were knocked over. This is Spirit Lake, one of the big tourist attractions before the eruption. And there was so much ash deposited here, it actually shifted the water out of the lake basin and moved it over a little bit. So part of Spirit Lake was in a new place. One of the most dramatic things that happens pretty much when all these cascade volcanoes erupt are mud flows. Because remember all that snow and ice up on the volcano, when it erupts, that stuff all melts and mixes with the ash. And so you get mudslides pouring down the side of the volcano into the river valleys, and they can flow for 100 miles or more down the river valley, just knocking out bridges. This is a piece of construction, a bulldozer here, a piece of construction equipment that was trapped in the mud flow hundreds of miles away from the volcano. So the damage can extend farther than the blast zone. And again, this is that same photo we had up earlier. After the eruption, there's been gradually a new dome forming here in the crater, so it's starting to rebuild itself. And as we've seen, some steam and ash coming out of it over the last year and a half or so. So that was a dramatic lesson in what these volcanoes are capable of. It wasn't a very large eruption compared to some of the historical ones, but it made people aware of the potential problems that can occur when these sort of volcanoes erupt. So, again, just to kind of get some perspective, this is on a flight out of Seattle heading back toward the Midwest. So this is Rainier, which we'll talk about next. St. Helens is here off the right flank of Rainier. This is Mount Adams, and right there is Mount Hood. So again, you can see several of them together if the conditions are right. And Rainier is the one, of course, that dominates the Seattle-Tacoma skyline. And if you think about how many people are living in the Seattle-Tacoma area, and again, think about what that small eruption of Mount St. Helens did, you can see that Rainier could cause some problems. Now, Rainier is the tallest of the Cascade volcanoes. It is over 14,000 feet. It blasted its top off down to about this level and then reformed a new dome inside of that crater. So it went through the destructive building phases a few times. Again, seen from the Seattle area, and now a little bit closer. And they get very heavily eroded, covered with glaciers, dozens of active glaciers coming off the volcano, and up on the side a little bit higher. So that the last big eruption was down to about this level, and then the rounded dome of the mountain is the lava dome that formed on top of that crater.
When was that?
I can't give you that date, I'm sorry. Another piece of missing info. So, this is, as I say, the biggest. Now, you can see Rainier from this area if you get high enough up. This is on top of Mount Furno, which is just behind Copper Mountain. So if you get up on the higher ridges and peaks here in Holden, you can see Mount Rainier off to the south. So that's 120 miles away from Holden, but you can see it from this direction. So standing on the same summit, this is looking southwest. If you turn and look straight west, then you see Glacier Peak. And again, that's about 20 miles away. And this is Glacier Peak a little bit closer up. It last erupted about 10,000 years ago. And it was another large eruption. It completely blanketed this whole valley with pumice and ash. And it's very easy to walk around and find pieces of Glacier Peak pumice lying on the ground. The pumice that we see now from Glacier Peak is kind of a yellowish rock. And one of the things that's distinctive about pumice is that it has lots of holes in it.
It's relatively light.
Yeah, it's actually more airspace than rock. And pumice will float on water. It's the one of the rocks that will float. You can sort of think about pumice like froth on top of a lava flow. And then it explodes out and solidifies, and it's really made of glass originally, the same volcanic glass that the ash is, but it's a frothy glass. And it's been sitting on the ground here for 10,000 years, so gradually that glass decomposes. That's why it's kind of a powdery yellow color now. But it's around here, especially if you get on the other side of the valley across the footbridge, you can find it. And most of the soil here, most of the topsoil, is made of volcanic ash from Glacier Peak. It's very fine, powdery stuff. And so the original parent material for the soil is that layer of ash.
So you don't get obsidian around here, like on the eastern Oregon volcanoes.
No, we don't have obsidian from this one. There might be some small deposits closer to the volcano, but none over here. But it was a massive eruption, just blanketed this whole landscape. It sort of would look like the pictures of that St. Helens eruption, the desolated landscape. That's what this valley would have looked like 10,000 years ago, just inundated with ash and pumice. Now, from the same high mountaintop, if you look northwest, this is Mount Baker. So that's the northernmost one here in the U.S., and this is Baker from close up. So just a couple shots of that. And so Baker, Rainier, and St. Helens are the three they're watching most closely these days for potential eruptions. Uh-oh. Okay, well, whatever. So that's been our tour. We've gone from Lassen and Shasta up through Crater Lake and Mount Hood, Mount St. Helens, Mount Rainier, Glacier Peak, and Mount Baker. So again, from Holden, you can see south to Mount Rainier, or you can see north to Mount Baker.
So that's the whole Cascade?
That's the whole Cascade Range there, yep.
The earthquake that shook St. Helens right before it erupted, was that considered a shallow earthquake?
Yes.
Are there any up in Canada then?
Well, yes, I'm sorry. There are a few that extend into British Columbia. Mount Garibaldi is about right here, and maybe another small cone north of that. So,
Shuckson?
I'm not sure if Shuckson's considered part of the But I have to check on that.
There was an underwater
showing crooks of steam there.
Yeah, last time I was up on the side of Mount Baker, there was steam coming out. Which is a little disconcerting when you're standing.
And Rainier has hot spots.
Yeah, yeah. So they've all got signs of activity.
What is Mount Rainier doing that they're concerned about?
It's mostly deeper seismic activity, deeper earthquake activity that makes them nervous enough. It's just so close to so many people that anything that happens there, they get a little nervous about.
Wasn't there an underground volcano south of Vancouver Island that people kind of, a couple of months ago, they were rushing to?
I didn't hear about that one.
It was underwater.
Wouldn't be impossible. Now, one thing to think about is that these Cascade volcanoes are just the latest generation of many generations of Cascade volcanoes that have been erupting here for as long as these two pieces of crust collide together. Just to give you a sense of that, this is a layer of ash from a Cascade volcano that erupted about 110,000 years ago. And you can trace the ash back to the volcano it comes from by the chemistry of it. So it's not hard to figure out where this ash came from. This layer of ash is in eastern Kansas. Think about how big an eruption you would need to put this layer of ash all the way into the center of the country.
Huge. Yeah. Bigger than St. Helens.
Much bigger than Seattle. Now, there are a couple other volcanic things about the area I want to mention briefly. We've been talking about cascades that run up through this part of the state. But just to the east of us is a giant lava plateau. And these are flows of fluid lavas. Not the sticky, viscous, explosive ones, but the fluid ones, the low silica ones. And they cover most of eastern Washington and northeastern Oregon. These are layer after layer after layer of lava flow. And when you drive from Spokane to Golden, you see those lava flow layers there. In some of the thickest places, these layers of lava total to over 2 miles thick. So we had a period of about 15 million years ago where over and over again, lava poured out of the earth in this part of the state and just covered the whole area. So it's pretty unusual. Sometimes when the lava cools, it cools into these odd vertical columns. They're almost perfect hexagonal shapes. It's just the distinctive way sometimes that lava cools and contracts into this shape. So that's one of the odd things you get in these thick lava flows. Now, the same sort of thing happened in southern Oregon. This is Craters of the Moon again in southern Oregon. This kind of lava flow comes out of a long crack in the ground. So you can see the crack here. It bubbles up in the crack.
It's crack in the ground.
And just flows in both directions. That's how you get the flat layers forming. Instead of a volcano forming around a single vent, you get flat layers that spread out across the landscape and build up one on top of the other. So this is the edge of those lava flows in southern Oregon.
Cool. You mean Idaho?
In Idaho, sorry. Southern Idaho.
Oh, okay, great.
And of course, we've got evidence of volcanic activity in Yellowstone.
Yeah.
Northwestern Wyoming. We've got the hot springs and geysers that are taking place in Yellowstone. So those are all related to volcanic activity and heat close to the surface that's heating the water, creating the hot springs and the geysers. So Yellowstone is essentially like Crater Lake. It's what's left after a big volcanic eruption. The only difference is that this hole didn't fill up with water. But you've got then heat close to the surface that's heating up the water and making all the geysers and stuff within that big crater. So Yellowstone is what's left of a volcano. Now, one other thing I want to point out, we looked at this diagram before. When you've got molten rock rising up to the surface to erupt as a volcano, Not all the rock makes it to, not all the lava makes it to the surface. Some of this lava rises and then gets stuck underground and solidifies underground. In fact, a lot of it solidifies underground. So when you've got volcanoes on the surface, you often have roots of the volcano down below the surface. Something like this. And then that rock can solidify in various shapes and sizes. So we say that that lava is intruded into the older country rock around it. It's hot lava injected into the rock underground, and then it cools and solidifies underground. It's pretty easy to recognize that kind of rock because it has this speckled appearance. This is what volcanic rock looks like when it cools underground. And these are individual minerals, some dark-colored minerals, some light-colored minerals, but you can get a sense of scale here from the paperclip. It's a speckled-looking rock. And if you walk around Holden, if you look at the rock walls, you see lots of speckled rock around here. Granite is probably the best known of this kind of rock, but there are other versions of granite that we have around here. It's always coarse-textured, and the individual minerals are relatively obvious. When lava erupts on the surface, you get little tiny crystals because it cools off so much faster. So you can see here, the same mineral crystals are present, but they're all smaller than the wire of the paperclip. Whereas before, the crystals were big enough. When you step back and don't use magnification, this rock looks like one solid dark color. You don't see the individual speckled appearance. So every volcano on the surface has other rock under it. And this, after everything's done erupting, the volcano can get eroded away, and this rock can get eroded away, and this other rock can now be exposed at the surface. So we can see the rock that formed underground later when it gets exposed by erosion. And the reason I say this is mostly what we've got here in the Railroad Creek Valley. The speckled rock we have in various places around here is this kind of rock that formed underground after the volcano that used to be above it is eroded away. So you'll see lots of this, and it's of various ages around here. Some is 70 million years old, and some is 40 million years old, and some is 22 million years old. So again, there have been volcanoes erupting in this part of North America for a very long time. And the modern-day Cascade volcanoes are just the last generation of, as I say, many generations of Cascade volcanoes. So you may see cracks that fill up with lava. And so you'd have cracks that are a different color than the darker rock around them.
Where's that?
This is actually in southern Colorado, but it's very dramatic.
It's huge.
It's the Black Canyon of the Gunnison River in Colorado. So we'll have a little sunset here over Glacier Peak and Image Lake. Hope it's been helpful. It's, as I say, a very fast look at what volcanoes are, and especially the Cascade volcanoes. Any last questions come to mind?
Yeah. What minerals would be in the lava in Hawaii that cause a compass just to spin around? You know, you can't get an accurate reading.
Some of the darker, low silica minerals that make up the fluid lavas are relatively high in iron and magnesium compared to the lighter colored stuff. So that might be the thing that throws them off, is somewhat higher iron content.
As of the brand Atlantic range. As that have in the places on raising level.
It has potential because we see that Iceland has been pushed. Iceland is part of that ridge that was pushed up above the water. So it's certainly possible that it could happen, but probably not.
Oh, good. How far is Image Lake?
About 18 miles by trail.
So it's not a one day hike.
it's a long day hike. I've known people that have done it. I haven't, but I've known people that have done it.
It would have recommended one.
Yeah.
On one of your first slides of the basalt, it looked like it was scooped. Was that for glaciers between the different basalt? It was in the middle of the cliff.
It probably could have been that, you know, the lavas would flow out across the landscape, mm-hmm. and then you'd get rivers and things, and they've got lakes that have formed in there. They find fossils of various kinds of animals. There's lots of petrified wood that shows up in between mm-hmm. these lava flows. So, you know, a normal ecosystem formed on top of the lava flow, and then another one came along and buried that landscape. Mm-hmm. So it could be little gullies and things that were
And we just
up.
Went to Dry Falls
sure.
a couple weeks ago. One time I was flying from Albuquerque up here, and it looked like there was the same kind of massive flood action, and I have no idea where I was, except it was somewhere close to New Mexico. Was there a massive flood down there too?
Well, I don't know about massive water floods. There are certainly in northern New Mexico big lava flows, big mm-hmm. fluid lava flows. El Malpais and some areas around there, miles and miles of lava flow mm-hmm. in some of those spots.
Okay.
Yeah. There's a question up here.
Yeah, Nancy. I was wondering about other places in the world, what is going on now, like Vesuvius, is it perfectly quiet?
Well, it's been quiet, certainly, but Mount Etna, just to the south of it on Sicily, was active within the last few years. So I don't think we could think that Etna is dormant yet. And of course, it's right beside the city of Naples, so lots of people there.
A fault, then, is the shifting.
Well, faults can shift any direction. So a fault is any crack along which the rock is shifted.
Okay.
And every time rock shifts, it's going to produce vibrations that we feel as earthquakes. So most of our earthquakes are associated with these shifting cracks. But also, as lava pushes up through rock, it pushes it aside, and that causes earthquakes too.
How about Japan? Do they have something going on over there too?
They have several active volcanoes there that they deal with on a regular basis. Yeah, they've got a lot of volcanic activity to contend with.
When was your last earthquake? Was that Kobe?
How about farther south, like we?
Fairly recently.
Way down into Africa. Disturbances there too.
The East African Rift is a place where Africa seems to be tearing apart. And there's volcanic activity along that rift zone, and that's been active within the last decade. There have been eruptions and lava flows there within the last decade. So
talking about areas like the Rift Valley.
Yep, yeah, right. Yep, and close by there. And so we've had volcanism in Central America and in Mexico and in South America and the South Pacific and Alaska. We've got plenty of places where activity's been happening. Well, there's been some great questions. I certainly want to thank you for coming along.